Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel.
The Second World War saw the amount of people in the skies reach unprecedented levels. Never before had so many people soared through the skies as the conflict continued across Europe, Africa, and Asia, and strange reports of odd things began to surface. These strange reports quickly became known as Foo Fighters, and it seemed that they followed both the Allies and the Axis pilots. Joining me to dissect and discuss this intriguing mystery is author, investigator, and lecturer, Graham Rendell. But before we join Graham, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. And you can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show with your contributions. It is greatly appreciated. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise store is available through TeePublic. The link is in the show notes. And thank you to the people who bought a t-shirt last week. It is greatly appreciated as well. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork. And the show is produced by Brennan Stall of the Ghost Story Guys. Let's welcome Graham as we go in search of the Foo Fighters phenomenon. Despite the plethora of books written about UFOs and ufology post-1947, often the focus can overlook many aspects of the subject. UFOs were seen well before 1947, and as man finally reached the skies in the early days of the 20th century, they too encountered strange things above them. My guest today, Graham Rendell, is an accomplished author, researcher, lecturer, and lover of all things aviation and UFOs, which for me is an excellent combination in this particular field. Graham, I'm delighted to finally welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters.
Hi, Paul. Thanks very much for the invitation. I'm honoured to be here. Thank you.
I'm honoured to have you on here. I was very fortunate enough, as I said to you earlier, before we started the interview proper, Graham, I saw you lecture at the Outer Limits Conference in September, diving into some incredible and fascinating cases from that sort of war period. And for me, as I sort of pulled your leg a little bit, you seem to be one of those people that I'm really aware of, and I'm really annoyed with myself that it's taken me this long to invite you to join me, because I've seen you speak on other shows, I've read 3 or 4 of your books, I've seen you talk in person. I think you're a phenomenal researcher, a wonderfully analytical mind when it comes to some of these sort of early reports, which I think we've just not had for so long, Graeme. You're a breath of fresh air in the field.
Oh, that's really kind of you to say, Paul. I mean, we did have a little bit of a chat before we started here, didn't we? And you know, we touched on the bit where I've said before to other people, you know, that the books I write are the ones I would like to have read myself when I was younger, and they just weren't there. And, you know, I don't think that's arrogance on my part. I think it's simply just, you know, maybe I've discovered some kind of niche in the market where, you know, these are things which I think that people might like to read, and they would have been ones I would have loved to have read, you know, sort of 40 years ago when I was, you know, 50 years ago, even actually, when I was getting into this, that I would have devoured, you know, titles like this. And I was just missing out on the kind of depth of detail that I really wanted to read in these books, because you get a paragraph if you were lucky about a case, and it was like, well, there must be more to this, surely. Where are you getting the information from? And I never got those answers, you know, book after book. And it would only be a handful of titles where I would get that. And those are the ones I really treasure, those types of book. So when I came to write my own, that's what I wanted to do. And I wanted to put footnotes in. I wanted to, you know, show people where I got the information from. As you say, I want to analyze cases. I want to go a bit more into the context of where they lie, and also, you know, things that happen around them, so that people get an idea of, you know, what the where, the when, and the how, but also what they're not as well, which is equally as important. So yeah, I mean, if I bring all that to the table, then, you know, I like to think I've succeeded, you know, in a small way, and maybe just enlightening a few people on some of the lesser known aspects of ufology. And as you mentioned there, you know, the World War II ones are certainly a bit of a Cinderella kind of, you know, sort of aspect to ufology.
Which came first for you then, Graeme? Was it a love of aviation that kind of led you into stories of other strange flying objects, or was it UFOs that kind of led you into aviation? Which one did you get the bug for first?
It was certainly the first. So aviation was where I started, and that I've said this to other people before, where I was given Airfix kits of Spitfires and Lightnings and Lancasters and all this kind of stuff when I was 4 year old. You know, my mum bought me these things to keep me quiet, and they did. But obviously, reading the, you know, the instructions on the Airfix model, the, you know, the when you build them, they'll have this little potted history. It was like 2 or 3 paragraphs worth of information about the aeroplane itself, and I used to like read that and read it and read it. And I would buy, you know, get books out of the library, and I get books given for Christmas and birthdays. So I started developing a, you know, an appreciation for all things flying. But at some stage, I was also interested in science fiction. So I came into UFOs by quite a roundabout route. And I was reading Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, you know, when I was about 8 year old. Mm. And my mum, God bless her, I mean, she's long gone now, but she bought me a book which she thought she was doing me a favour by buying me another Isaac Asimov book with these wonderful renditions of spaceships on the front, you know, the kind of Chris Foss amazing artwork that you have on these two. He was quite a well known name for that kind of artwork.
Yes.
And she bought me this book, and it was by Brinsley the Poet Trench. It was Mysterious Visitors. It had a great big flying saucer on the front of it. And it was about, you know, historical UFOs and, you know, going back to biblical times, but also talks about, you know, talks about some more contemporary stuff as well, and touches on quite a lot of different aspects of ufology. So that was a great kind of grounding, you know, for an initial book that like fired up my imagination. Not that I believed all of it straight away, but it was a case of, wow, what is this? You know, and being like a sponge back then, you know, I don't know if you're the same, but I've come across a lot of people like me who just, you know, they get their teeth into something and then they just want to read everything they can. So yeah, I picked up a few more UFO books along the way. You know, J. Allen Hynek, I had both of his books by about the age of 10 or 11, The UFO Experience and The UFO Report. I had both of them. So you can kind of tell I was quite precocious. I was quite an early reader, and I was, you know, as I say, I was devouring these books. Now, somewhere along the way, I've lost some of them, but I've had to reacquire them through, you know, eBay, everybody's friend. you pick up copies again that you've had when you were a kid. But I still managed to keep quite a lot of the books from back then. So I've got a fair library in terms of, you know, paperbacks and hardbacks that I've amassed over the years. And now, because obviously you can get almost anything through the internet, the stuff that I had, the gaps in my collection, you know, you'd see the footnotes for books occasionally where other authors got information from. Yeah. And some of those books were kind of almost the holy grail to me, because I'd never seen those books in the library. I'd never seen them in a bookshop. And they were just names on a page. And then finally, you know, it's maybe 20, 30, 40 years later, I've actually got a copy in my hand. And it's just a wonderful feeling, you know. But some of these, the names of the magazines as well, like Fate and Look magazine, I used to see them in the likes of John Keel's books, or even Timothy Good would occasionally refer to them. And to me, you know, I'd never seen copies of those, because come from a provincial town in northern England in the 70s and the 80s, you were never going to see things like that in a pre-internet age. Yeah. So, yeah, it was when I finally did get copies of these, or the Saga UFO report, all this kind of stuff. I've got a nice little collection now of all this material. So, yeah, it's brilliant. Really happy.
Well, I think it is. It's fascinating, really. I mean, I'm very, very similar. We're a very similar vintage, you and I, Graham. And I'm one of those people, I can't tell you what got me into UFOs, but I loved horror. I loved science fiction. I'm of that sort of Star Wars generation. I think I was 5 when Star Wars hit. My brother became far more obsessed with it than I did. I remember the days where we had to watch Star Wars before he went to school, and as soon as he came after school, every day for about a year and a half. To the point I began to think I was C-3PO. I'd seen the film that bloody much. But it's something I think that I can sort of put a flag down in the early 80s for when the Rendlesham and Alan Godfrey cases happened. Primarily as a northerner as well. Very similar. I grew up in a small town like you did, Graham, a little bit further down than yourself, but not too far for us northerners. I'm only the next county down, near enough. And so I've always felt that I've had this kind of interest in it since I probably could read, I suspect.
Yeah.
Especially with the Usborne books that came out at the end of the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the Hopkinsville Goblin stared at me throughout my younger days to the point that when they were re-released the other year, I lapped those three books up, Graham. Even though I'm a middle-aged man, I wanted to have those books again, because very similar to you, very cherished some of these books that really fired my imagination and took me to places all around the world I'd never heard of. That life gets in the way and you lose the moving house, different relationships, university, jobs. And so, yeah, I'm like you. I just hoover stuff up. Charity shops, I find all kinds of wonderful things, and you just those little free libraries. I don't know if you've got many of them in your neck of the woods, but round here in Sheffield we've got lots of little libraries where people just basically dump their books. And there's somebody around here who's got a very interesting esoteric library, because I found some absolute belters for nothing in our local free library. So you just never know, do you? I mean,
you stumble across them in the most unlikely places as well. We've got a charity shop at the top of Weardale, and they had a couple of books. They had one of those kind of Osborne type books that I remember from the 1970s.
Yeah.
And of course that was, you know, 50 pence, and that took that home with me, because that's going to add to my library. You know, it's not going to increase my sum of knowledge, because it's aimed at kids, and it had nothing that I didn't know about before.
Yeah.
But I wanted a copy of it, you know, just as you said there.
Well, it is. I think it's important, because, I mean, that sometimes happens to me. I remember buying a book about cryptids from my local Oxfam, and when I bought it, the guy says, "You do know this is for children?" And I said, yes, I do. I don't know whether he could look at me and think, that man clearly doesn't have any children in his house. I don't know how he knew that, but anyway, he decided to make a point of it, Graham. Well, I don't know what he thought my reading age was, but I suppose all this wonderful interest that you had in regards to aviation, do you think that by having that sort of love of that particular subject, that has then enabled you to look at some of these reports and have access to the flight records and the statements made, you as someone with that sort of insight to normal aviation, you were better qualified to go digging into these things, because you knew where these things might be squirreled away? Because often most of us who have an interest in this will know that there was always this negativity associated with anybody, especially commercial or military pilots, coming forward to say, "I've seen something strange in the sky." You just didn't do it. If you wanted to never fly again, the best way to do that was to say you'd seen something strange in the skies whilst you were flying a plane.
Yeah, it's a career-ending move. Yeah, I think I have had a, I guess if I have had an advantage, then it is knowing about sometimes about where to get some of this information from. I guess, yeah, because I've written a couple of aviation, you know, sort of themed books before. I wrote the first book on UFOs, which was UFOs Before Roswell, about the Foo Fighters of World War II, another associated phenomenon as well. So, yeah, I mean, I knew where military records were, and specifically, you know, how to get squadron records, how to get air intelligence records, that kind of thing. So I know where they are in the National Archives. I know which ones you can just pick up from your own computer at home. I know which ones you have to actually go and visit in person to get. Whereas maybe the average person who is interested in UFOs wouldn't have the first clue about where to look for that kind of stuff. So if I have any kind of advantage, that's where it is. But also, I guess, just knowing about the context of World War II, when I'm writing a book about Foo Fighters, you know, I've had a long-standing interest in German secret weapons, and that goes back to about the same sort of time as I picked up the UFOs. Yes. So I've got an idea about, you know, the where, the when, and the how. So I can tell a story in terms of, you know, about people seeing strange things, and then say, well, look, this is not what they are, because a lot of the talk is that all of them, they're just German secret weapons. Well, you know, I can say why they're not for a whole variety of reasons. And rather than just say that and just put that as a statement out there, I can back it up with facts. So that's, you know, maybe a service that I'm trying to provide people when they read the books. Then they've got this extra bit of context around the sightings. So it helps people understand about what's happening, not just for the sighting itself, but also, you know, what might have been and what wasn't the cause of the sighting itself. So whether it was something mundane, whether it was something, you know, out of the ordinary, and maybe somewhere in between. I mean, just for an example, there is a not a really a famous case, but it keeps cropping up on the internet and in certain books about December 1943, and this object that was seen by bomber crews over Germany was actually near Emden. And it appeared in a squadron newsletter, 115 squadron. It was called Bang On. It was the name of the newsletter, and they're talking about this little kind of object that had this huge long white exhaust trail going up behind it. And it turns out that based on the location, the time frame, and what it looked like, that was a Messerschmitt Comet, one of the rocket fighters. And they were deploying them there before for tests. And this one probably got too close to where the bomber stream was. And the actual shape of the object, this long white plume of exhaust, that and this, the speed of it and about the size, it kind of fits the area. So it's not categoric, like, you know, an explanation, but you can write that one off as a comet. Whereas other things that were seen back then, they don't have that kind of, you know, the surety that you can say that was definitely something German. A lot of the things are just completely out of this world, you know, metaphorically and you know, realistically. So, you know, coming up with that kind of information to say, well, this one probably wasn't something, you know, out of the ordinary, whereas all these other things were, and we can't explain what those were, that kind of, you know, sets them apart. And it does provide people with a bit of a, you know, sort of, well, yeah, some of these things you can actually explain away, but others you definitely can't. Another thing is that because I know my way around these military records, I can look up some of the witnesses and I can see whether they were actually on the squadron at the time they say they were. And there's at least one case that appeared in a certain author's book. I'm not going to say who, but, you know, it was heralded this you know, World War II case. But the guy who was supposed to be the witness, well, he wasn't even in the squad, wasn't flying for the squadron at the time. So how did he, you know, actually know what had gone on that raid? You know, so you have that kind of detail which you can get into, and then you can put it on the page yourself, you know, to say, well, look, you know, there's something wrong with this particular case. You know, I'm not entirely convinced that actually what this guy says happened. Which again is another service, because you don't want to just be nodding your head at everything that somebody says about UFOs. You need to be a bit discriminating. You know, you need to call out things that you're not sure about or that you can prove which weren't, you know, happening in the first place. So yeah, you know, there's no sacred cows in ufology. I've always believed that, you know, sooner or later some cases do fall by the wayside, but at least it gives us the opportunity to concentrate on the others that demand more scrutiny. So yeah, I think, you know, doing that kind of things a service to people who read the books as well.
Absolutely. And I think, as you just said that and given that example, Graham, that's a prime example, because I think often when we talk about this, because I also specialized in Second World War history, I tended to keep my focus on the ground. And what I can't tell you about the Anglo-German naval agreement of 1936 isn't worth knowing, Graham. But this is neither the platform nor the show.
Size of battleships.
Me and Joachim von Ribbentrop go back a long time. And so I've always had a real interest in that. And like I say, because the pantheon of war and the whole machinations of it and what was going on. And like you say, what the Nazis were up to and what they weren't up to and what people have prescribed to them. Historically, often, unless you know or have read or have access to the proper books about these particular subjects, then yes. And I suppose often it's probably easier to discredit some examples that have been doing the rounds prior to the internet, before people had access to these kind of archives and records, Graham, where people could just say these silly stories and say, oh, well, it was... This was the name of the crew and that's who they were. And either thinking, well, nobody will ever be able to check, or these people will have passed on by the time this information may have come, or even they never presumed anything. You know, somebody writing in 1982 about UFOs, I doubt would have any idea what was coming down the line 20 years later with the internet. So
probably not.
You having that sort of knowledge and experience, I think, is a phenomenal strength for both your research and your writing, because you're able to sort the wheat from the chaff. Because I think the thing about the Foo Fighters subject is it seems to have just really just been knocked out of the scope of ufology, I think, for quite a long time, until your book kind of pulled it back in. Because I think too many people are very quick to say, yeah, it was just people not understanding what was going on, and it was reactions to exhausts and test fighters and new fuels and all this, and it was only happening to the Allies. And I thought, well, hang on a minute, I read stuff about the Germans and the Japanese having experiences seeing these things as well as the Allies, so how can it be both? Because they clearly weren't flying the same planes, they clearly weren't using the same fuel, it's a war. So that straight away made me start to think, I think there's a bit more to this. And I think this explanation that it was just people who had no understanding of the sky and the air around them, it's nonsensical. I mean, when I grew up, as many northern towns and villages, Graham, we had a lot of Polish settler after the Second World War, because a lot of them came over here.
The resettlement, yes.
Part of the invasion, and a lot of them went down the pits. A lot of them had history in mining, but also, you know, a lot of them flew for the RAF in the Battle of Britain and stayed in. You know, if it wasn't for the Poles, I'm not really too sure we'd have kept them at bay for much longer. And so I remember when I was a young chap, one of our neighbours, he flew for the RAF. He was Polish, and he told me he would always see strange balls around German fighters, and he presumed it was some kind of special thing that the Germans had. They weren't sure if it was a light that they got set up that was trying to disorientate enemy fighters or whatever, he said, but I knew for a fact that that wasn't supposed to be there. I don't know what it was. He didn't say, oh, I thought it was a UFO or an alien. And at that, when you hear that from a first-hand witness, really sort of fires you up, and you think, well, if he's prepared to explain that and share that with me, then that, for me, gives it more credence, because then straight away, I've got somebody who flew for the Allies telling me about them thinking it was a Nazi weapon.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not just the Foo Fighters as well, because that's a specific kind of like set of lights that followed or were seen by kind of night fighter crews over Europe and then at different places as well. There were other things like, you know, structured objects that were seen throughout the war. But I think in terms of like, you know, because everybody just lumps it as a Foo Fighter, but I think they came along at maybe the wrong time, if you like, because they came along 2 years before the birth of the modern day UFO phenomenon in June 47. People didn't really know about, you know, or have any understanding about, you know, aliens or potential aliens or, you know, flying saucers, flying discs, whatever you want to call them. Everybody just thought or assumed that they were some kind of enemy secret weapon, because what else would they be? Mm-hmm. You know, in the heat of a conflict, especially a worldwide conflict, they're going to be the enemy's secret weapon. And of course, there's the anecdotal stories, and that's all they are, unfortunately, anecdotal stories of Japanese and German pilots seeing these things as well and assuming they're the other sides. And I wish I had a pound for every time somebody's told me, oh, well, the Germans saw these too, because I wish they would point me in the direction declaration of a document that actually proves it. Because as try as I can, I might, I'm still looking through. I mean, I've just come back from London last week when I was in the National Archives, yet again, looking through prisoner of war, Luftwaffe prisoner of war counts, amongst other things, air intelligence files, to find any kind of information I can about, you know, whether, you know, the Germans actually did report to anybody seeing these things as well. Now, there are some fragments in those that were asked questions in terms of the German knife fighter pilot called Schnaufer. He was the probably the top ace in terms of the Nachtjag, the German knife fighter force. He downed 121 aircraft. Mm. You know, that makes him an expert. And, you know, he was the top night fighter ace. And he was asked directly after the war, a couple of months after the war, about these strange flashes and lights and stuff. And he didn't know anything about it. You know, to him, that was something that he'd never heard of. So that you have occasionally reference to these questions, but the people who I've read into, they don't have any knowledge of this. So sooner or later, I'll probably find something, but it's a long process. But going back to what I was saying before about, you know, coming at the wrong time, the air intelligence people on you know, presumably the enemy side, but certainly on the Allied side, the Americans and the British, there's a long kind of trail of reports in terms of the RAF, bomber crew, the bomber commands, what they call the operational research section, looking at lights that are following aircraft as early as March 1940. So you're going back quite a long way there. And they have these things and they don't know what they are. They keep compiling certain sections of reports month after month after month. And they get to a point in about end of 1942 where they just basically call a halt because they have no idea what they're looking at. They're not doing anything particularly, you know, harmful. They're just following the bombers. Mm. And sometimes for long distances, like 250 miles at a time. And sometimes on the way back from the targets as well. So it's not as if they're trying to find out where they're going. They're trying to find out, you know, that they're following them on the way home, which is really strange. Yeah. Anyway, so there's all this going on. And then the talk about projectiles in about 1941, 1942. They couch them in the terminology of the time. So from lights, they become rockets or projectiles. And these things that zigzag after aircraft. And that's about a year, maybe 18 months before the Germans managed to field the first testing of the surface-to-air rocket of an anti-aircraft missile, like Schmetterling or Enzian, these times the things that they were experimenting with, or Reintochter.
Yes.
And then a bit later on, so you're talking about mid-1944 or towards the beginning of the autumn, they start encountering things that they call jets. And the air gunners are seeing things that look like exhaust plumes or just very fast moving lights. They don't even see any structure behind them. Mm. They're just very, very quick lights. And they assume that they're these new jets operating at night. But again, it's before the Germans actually have aircraft, which are flying, jet aircraft flying at night. Mm. Even though they have an inkling that they're probably going to see them at some stage. But the first jet night fighter unit didn't start operations until December 1944. And that was only one person with one aircraft.
Yes.
And then it got a little bit bigger in January 45. And then the first purpose-built jet night fighters came along at the end of March 1945, just like 6 weeks before the end of the war. So you can see from that kind of history that the scale of the phenomenon, you know, can't be explained by the facts on the ground in terms of German technology. It just doesn't exist. It's not in the right place at the right time, in the right time period, to actually be the things that these air gunners were seeing. And in some cases, they were saying they'd actually shot them down. So what the hell were these things? Because they certainly weren't conventional piston engine aircraft. They weren't the Ju-88s or the Henkel 219s that the Germans were flying against the bombers. So it's all very, very strange. You know, when you read through some of the mission reports and in the squadron records from the National Archives, none of it makes a lot of sense, but it's definitely there and it's definitely being reported, sometimes night after night. But it's quite patchy as well, because unfortunately a lot of the squadron coverage, depending on which squadron you're looking at, some, you know, the clerks and the people who were responsible for putting all this information together, some of it you clearly thought that they didn't really want to do it, and it was very, very sketchy, whereas some had a little bit more information and others was quite, you know, it was quite copious about how much notes they actually, the kind of amounts of notes that they made. So you think from that that some of these units probably did actually see quite a lot of stuff, But you know, simply the scale of reporting wasn't there in terms of what we can look at. So you just wonder what was and what wasn't reported.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I suppose as well, Graham, you have to look at that particular period of history, and it was probably the most amount of people who were in the air at the same time ever up until that point, primarily, yeah. Because we'd never had real air combat. I know there were some, you know, we'd got biplanes flying about during the First World War, but there wasn't really a conflict that was fought on all three aspects, yeah. Air, land and sea, prior to the Second World War. And I think, yes, you could kind of say, well, you had a lot of people there who were sort of drafted and weren't really sure about the skies or whatever. But you had people who were experienced flyers on all sides. Mm. You know, they weren't just pulling everybody in off the street and saying, right, there you are. There's a get jump in that, mate, and off you go.
Got it.
You know, no. And they had to go through a serious amount of training. I know sometimes they cut corners because they needed people in the air or as quickly as possible. But you only have to look at the sheer volume of people who were in the RAF just for us, Graham, in the UK, never mind all the other countries that were involved. I mean, I strangely, as I was talking about discovering wonderful books, I stumbled across an author I'd never heard of who wrote a series of books called Ghost Stations, which were all about haunted airfields.
Yeah.
And it was amazing to me, but that book shocked me. Because it gave a breakdown of how many people were in the RAF, how many people flew, how many people died, how many people were injured. And I was just like, these are incredible numbers that you just cannot get your head around.
No.
And so that's just us. And you would imagine it's the same in Germany. It would be the same in Italy. The States would probably be considerably more, the Japanese and anybody else that could get anybody in the air, depending on which side they were in. So you have thousands and thousands of people in the air over a 5 or 6 year period, and they're all seeing weird things. Now, I, like you say, I can't get my head around the fact that a lot of them have just been dismissed as misidentification or people just not understanding it. Yes, there will be some that were like secret tech and perhaps planes that were flying sorties just to get a bit of experience, getting used to having something so powerful, I would imagine, for a lot of them, Graham. And they didn't want to put them in a combat situation until they knew that the pilots could handle them and they knew the foibles. Because you know, planes might look similar, but they all fly and they're way different and they've different maneuverabilities and different aspects to them. It's not that simple. And so when you've got these kind of situations going on, there's going to be weird things happening that really experienced people are like, what the hell is this? Because as you say, you've got these reports of things being shot down on both sides. Like you say, it is very frustrating, because I'd love to know what the German archives are like, Graham, in regards to how much information they kept from the Second World War, because I know they had a bit of a sort of cleansing. I wouldn't say it was a purge.
It's patchy, Paul. Yeah. It's rather patchy because there are certain years which don't exist, and it's because some of the records were destroyed or lost at the end of the war. The yes. Americans got quite a lot of it, especially for the Luftwaffe archives. Mm. I think there's at least 1 year missing. But actually, in terms of, I mean, I mentioned the first German jet night fighter unit. It was 11 staff of NGG 10. It was called Commander Welter beforehand. It was because he was the guy who ran the unit. And he was basically flying on his own throughout December. And then he started training a few other people to fly with him the following year. The records for that unit are actually available. So it was only in existence for about 6 months, but you can actually read what they're called the daily records, the Turkish ones, and also the loss records, you know, for the aircraft that they claimed they shot down, but also for their own losses as well, and where they operated. And actually, that unit was basically tied to Berlin because it was an anti-mosquito unit. Because the mosquitoes of the raids. Only pinpick raids, because they would fly independently of the main bombers, whichever targets they were flying against over Germany. But night after night, mosquitoes were basically bombing Berlin, and they were a real thorn in the side of the Luftwaffe. And so these jets were basically designed to try and shoot down mosquitoes raiding Berlin, and they were only tied to Berlin. They wouldn't operate anywhere else over Germany. So a lot of the time when people just say, oh, well, they were probably just German jets. Well, no, they weren't. Especially if it was over the Ruhr, or if it was over Austria or Munich or whatever, because those jets didn't operate in those areas. They operated within a fixed radius of Berlin, and actually, you know, very sparingly, because they didn't have that many aircraft. They probably had about 19 aircraft maximum at any one time, and that was probably towards the last few months of the war. So you can see that from the records as well as to which aircraft they had and when and where they operated. So we can build up this picture of what was possible and what wasn't. And it's the stuff that wasn't possible that then ties in with the sightings from other places. And that's when we kind of scratch our heads and think, well, what were these things? You know, what was being seen over the likes of Romania or Bulgaria, you know, Austria, southern Austria, what was Czechoslovakia, Hungary, in the spring of and summer of 1944, because lights were seen following aircraft there at night, sometimes surrounding aircraft, you know, 6-7 lights seen flying around an aircraft. And these were reported by RAF crews who were based in Italy, who were raiding the likes of the Plesti synthetic oil refineries
yes.
and other targets throughout the Balkans. Mm. So you're looking at 35 Squadron, 40 Squadron, 178 Squadron, all these different units which are flying night operations over the Balkans. And of course, that's a bit of a forgotten war in yes. terms of, you know, people who read into these things. So it's the quiet part of the war where people don't know that much about. And when I started digging into the squadron records for these, it was like, what? You know, there's all these kind of like little bits of information about potential UFO sightings, and nobody's ever looked at these before. Nobody's ever published any of this information. Now, it doesn't add up to a lot because there's a very sparse kind of details, but if you put it all together, it shows that there was definitely something going on which can't be explained by the kind of technology that the Luftwaffe were fielding at night, because they didn't really have that many night fighters operating in the Balkans in 1944 anyway. So it was quite patchy, the coverage. So this is when you start like kind of scratch your head and think, well, what was exactly going on? But as far as I'm aware, and nobody's ever been able to tell me otherwise, nobody has ever looked at this before with a UFO hat on. So, you know, I'm the first. And the information I brought regarding that particular part of the war in UFOs before Roswell has never been seen before. Mm. And so I think if I've got any legacy that I might pass on to future generations, I'd like that kind of thing to be it. The stuff that people have never seen before. And I'm luckily the first person who's dived into that, you know, so it's a great feeling. Yes. I wish somebody had done it before, because it would make, you know, kind of things a lot easier for people, but I'm happy to be the first.
Does that strike you as peculiar, Graham? Because it strikes me as odd. I don't understand.
No, I don't think it doesn't really. And I'll explain why. It's because it's very difficult to work out what kind of records you need to look at. Mm. as I said to a lot of people in the past, you can't just rock up at the National Archives and Kew Gardens in London and say, give me your UFO files. It doesn't work that way. Yeah. Yes, with the help of Dr. David Clark, who a lot of people who watch this probably will know of, you know, they have released tranches of UFO files from the Ministry of Defence over the last, 20 years or so. Yes. But those are primarily things from about the late 1970s onwards. And they're kind of people writing into the MOD, to the UFO desk, you know, Nick Pope and the people who were serving in that role, you know, either side of him, saying, I saw this strange light in the sky, or there's a couple of airliner cases in there, obviously the Calvin cases in there as well, in those files. But largely, it's kind of like people just seeing strange lights in the sky and reporting it to the UFO desk. There's not a lot of other stuff, and there's obviously some weird stuff in there, you know, people coming up with missives of page and page and page of rambling, basically. So it's quite patchy, the information when you look at it. And it doesn't go back that far in terms of decades. But, you know, the stuff beyond that, if you want to start diving into the UFO cases from the World War II, Dave Clark actually did come out with a lot of stuff. You know, he pointed people in the direction of some of the air intelligence files. But actually, there's stuff beyond that as well. You have to dive into the operational research section for Bomber Command and their intelligence files, their monthly summaries. There are other air intelligence files which, you know, for the life of me, nobody would find in a million years would know how to look for them unless they have any kind of specific knowledge of how the air intelligence worked during World War II. You know, how these things, the kind of language that the file names are listed under, because they're not listed under UFO or strange lights or stuff like that. But they do have words like phenomena. They do have words like, you know, jet-propelled aircraft. So you have to hit these kind of words in a search to try and find these documents. And then, even then, when you find the files, sometimes there's nothing of value in them. So I spend quite a frustrated time occasionally, and yes, that was 2 days last week, looking through stuff and finding only a few things and sometimes nothing at all. And then occasionally you'll find a file where it goes, wow, you know, there's a lot of stuff in here. It's quite peculiar how you do it. But yeah, you do have to have a sense of how it all worked back then in terms of how things are reported, the manner it was reported, and the names of the kind of reports, etc., that were written back then by air intelligence, air technical intelligence, and the various kind of air ministry departments who used to look at this kind of stuff. Another one is flak liaison officers. And that you know, I never knew what they were until about maybe 20 years ago. And it turns out they were army artillery officers who had an idea about anti-aircraft guns, who used to fly in our bombers, but also American Air Force by day. And they would, you know, they were experts on flak, and they would fly your missions and they would report back afterwards. There's quite a lot of the UFO information in their reports as well, in terms of strange things that were seen. So this is the kind of knowledge that you need in order to try and get that information out of the records. And of course, not every UFO, many UFO researchers would probably have that knowledge.
I suppose one of the interesting aspects of this is that there wasn't this sort of problem for pilots, Graham, that we see very quickly from Roswell onwards, when the world goes UFO crazy from 1947 onwards. The bits I've seen and the work I've seen you present and discuss, there doesn't seem to be this fear of being tarnished for seeing strange things. I suspect that was because we're in a war, and therefore, if you're seeing strange objects or strange lights in the sky, you have to notice them because you don't know what they are. And therefore, surely people need to know about this. You have to report it back to your superiors, to the intelligence officers that will be working from Whitehall.
Yeah.
These are important things. In a war, nothing's off the table for discussion, because at the end of the day, it's all about protecting the population and making sure you're dealing with things. When you've been looking at this, are people very matter of fact? Because I love reading some of these war reports, because they often seem to be just very meat and two veg, Graham. Here's the facts. We're not going to dress it up. I'm not going to tell you what I think it is. I'm just going to say, this is what we saw. Me, Steve and Brian saw it. It followed us for 30 minutes. It was a bit weird. Or words to that effect. There's none of this flowery language that we start to see in the modern age of ufology, it would seem.
They don't have the space or the time to do it. It's all immediate. They need to have the information there and then to analyse it and find out what's going on. To them, any scrap of information is worthwhile. And obviously, when bomber crews came back from a mission. They were debriefed. So they had to sit around a table. You know, they wanted to get to bed, but they had to sit around a table with the squadron intelligence officer or one of these minions, to be a flight lieutenant or that kind of rank. And they would have to tell them what had happened during the raid. So, you know, when time they took off, what did they find en route? You know, what were the flak defenses like? Did they have any night fighter attacks? How did they cope with these things? Did they drop the bombs on time? Did they see anything unusual en route? This kind of stuff. You know, all that information was written down, catalogued, filed away. It was then passed on to other agencies to have a look at, to interpret, to analyze, to come up with new strategies to maybe combat new weapons that the Germans start to field, or whether they had to reroute bomber streams around maybe an airfield which had new flak guns, or they were protecting a factory or something like that, and so that rather than fly straight over the top of the guns and get shot down, or because there were new searchlights somewhere, they'd go around them, and this is all information that they needed. But wrapped up in all this stuff were these stories of strange lights or strange objects sometimes that were seen in the course of missions. And of course, that's not just the RAF bomber crews at night. You're getting this from the US Army Air Force from the start of 1943, because that's when the Americans start running daylight raids over Germany from Britain. So you're starting to see reports from them of strange things they're seeing in the daytime as well, which can't be accounted by German day fighters or by flak gun bursts, pyrotechnics, all this kind of stuff. So you see the reports like that, but also you're seeing things, reports from aircraft flying over the Atlantic. So whether they're on anti-submarine raids missions, or they're just flying transport aircraft from America across to Africa or what have you, you know, they're seeing these things as well. So there's reports from, you know, various places, and it's all very, very strange. But it gets, you know, it gets reported, it gets passed up the chain of command, it gets analysed, but of course they don't know what they're looking at because there's no frame of reference apart from, oh, well, it must be German, you know, new technology. You get that when you look at the Foo Fighter information and how that's passed from the US Army Air Force's night fighter units in Europe, so the 415th and the 422nd, one's based in France, one based in Belgium. And they're looking at these things. And one of the intelligence officer from the 415th is a guy called Fred Ringwald, who's a captain. In mid-December 1944, because he's getting day after day after day of these reports, he starts compiling a list. And by the end of January, he has about 14 different things on this list. I mean, there's more of them, but this is what the ones he wrote down. Mm-hmm. And he passes it up the chain of command, like anybody would do then. Yes. If there's something they don't understand, you know, send it high, because they're the people supposed to deal with it. And of course, there's backwards and forwards from from his superiors in wing headquarters, and they don't know what they're looking at. So they pass it up even further up the chain of command to the Tactical Air Force, 12th Tactical Air Force. They don't know, so they pass it up to 1st Air Force. It gets then passed up to 8th Air Force. It keeps going up levels, and then it comes back down, because the questions are, well, what part of the aircraft are these lights fitted to? Well, it's clearly a misunderstanding, because they never said these lights are fitted to an aircraft. They're just lights. So senior intelligence officers had no concept of what was going on, because clearly they were thinking in conventional terms, whereas the phenomenon, whatever it is and was, defied description other than these are lights which are chasing after our aircraft. And of course, there was one particular report that went up the chain which said, you know, these aircrew have encountered a phenomenon which they cannot understand. And that was the phrase they used. So, you know, when you see it couched in that kind of language, people should have sat up and take note. But by the end of the war, well, you're talking at March 1945, the inquiries, the Americans basically just didn't know what they were looking at. They passed the inquiries to the British Air Ministry in Whitehall and said, look, you tell us what these are, because we don't know. And about 6 weeks later, March 1945, the 12th of March, a letter came back to the American Air Force, to the headquarters of the 8th Air Force, saying, we think they're legitimate 262 jet fighters or possibly some kind of flak rocket. And that was the final determination. They couldn't think of anything else. Because, well, what else would they be? Mm. You know, UFOs didn't exist. Flying saucers didn't exist then. So they're not going to be little green men. They're going to be something the Germans have cooked up. And that was the final determination. And they never budged from that. Mm. So, yeah, that's how it ended, basically. Yeah. And, 6 weeks later, the war ended in Europe and the sighting ceased. Primarily because, very few people were flying after that. They didn't need to fly as many missions anymore. So you didn't have those tens of thousands of trained observers flying over the continent night after night anymore. The report still happened in the Far East, but they tailed off as soon as the war ended across there as well. And it wasn't until, the Swedish sighting started and then in June 47 and things started ramping up again, even though there were some sightings in between, but not as many as there had been.
Mm. I mean, I think that's one of those things that people always kind of say, oh, well, once the war finished, people stopped seeing things. And I thought, well, of course, because nobody's looking at the sky anymore.
Yeah.
Because you're not watching for rockets or planes coming in, Graham. And I think sometimes people make these statements without quantifying them. Anybody who lived in the UK, we know that most coastal areas, anything industrialised was bombed the hell out of. It's the same, and we did the same in Europe. You had people out every night. You had air wardens. We had alarms. Everybody was there. Once war ceased, all these people, everybody starts getting back to normal. Everybody's got to rebuild. That's right. Doesn't matter which side you're on, we've all got to rebuild. For people to say, oh, well, they stopped when the war finished. Well, they will do. Because you've got no, there's not thousands of planes flying everywhere anymore. Everybody's kind of right. Let's get forwards. And so I always find that gap from the war ending, and then obviously, like you say, you've got the ghost rockets phenomena that was going off in Sweden and Scandinavia. Once again, people have said, oh, well, that was the Russians testing some secret rocket that the Russians never launched and never used. So,
yeah, my question to that is, well, where did they launch them from? Because Peenemünde was basically leveled in February 1945 by the Germans.
Yeah.
It ceased to exist as a facility. There was no launching pads. There were no buildings to speak of where they could actually build these things. And there were no examples of the rockets left anyway, because they basically demolished everything in Peenemünde. I've actually visited Peenemünde. I've been there. Yeah. I've looked around the facilities. I've walked around what's left of the place. And it's pretty much like what was left by at the end of the war. The Russians moved in and they had troops and stuff there, but they couldn't do anything because there was nothing there for them to work with anymore. And all the technology, they basically shipped back to Russia anyway. Mm. And that was far too far away from Sweden to launch things. It was about, 60 miles from Peenemünde across to Ystad in southern Sweden.
Yeah.
So there was no way that was going to happen. But yeah, that was the working kind of like theory. They were Russian in origin. But even at the end of the war, people started to think, well, these things must have been German. So, of course, there was this big scouring of German industry to try and find out what they were. I mean, with other things as well, they were trying to find out what the Germans were working on just in a whole variety of subjects, whether it was aircraft research, whether it was to do with metals or chemicals or even dentistry. You can see all these reports on all these things. Mm. I found the index to the so-called BIOS reports, the British Intelligence Objectives Subcommittee, all the stuff they looked at after the war, and that's just the British side. And there's like 300 pages in the document of just the index of all the files that have all those things. There are thousands of reports when you add the SIOS, which is the American side of it, and also the other associated programs. They were looking at everything across Germany in 1945. And there's thousands of reports, and you can read them. If you know what you're looking for, again, you can find these reports on all these weird and wonderful, sectors of German industry, including rockets, including jets, including advanced propulsion systems. But nothing adds up to what the Foo Fighters were. And of course, they never found anything like that in a factory somewhere or in a testing facility or in an airfield. Nobody who knew anything about it either. I found a document where they questioned a dozen high-ranking Luftwaffe flak officers, people who were in to do with their training, and also people like Eric Backham, who was responsible for the NATA, for the Point Defense Jet, a rocket-powered interceptor, which was fielded or nearly fielded towards the end of the war. So people like that would have had a handle on stuff like this, or they would at least had an inkling about what was going on. And none of them knew anything about it. They claimed no knowledge at all. They all thought it was something like the Natter. But again, that was never fired in anger, and the only manned test flight and ended in disaster for the pilot. So these things were never, ever used in anger. So they certainly weren't ever the Foo Fighters, and of course, they're in the wrong place at the wrong time anyway. So, you know, you can write these things off. But clearly the Germans thought, well, it must have been one of ours, but we're just not sure what it was. But it wasn't, you know, because you can rule all these things out. So they have these questionings that happen throughout the summer of 1945, and they get nowhere. The Americans get absolutely nowhere in trying to work out what they are. But still, that kind of thinking that, oh, well, the Germans must have been responsible, that persists into 1947, because you see newspaper reports for when the first UFO like stories come out in June, that year. There's letters to newspapers saying, oh, these things must be the same as the so-called Foo Fighters that appeared 2 years ago. In fact, I was looking at a couple of those types of letters today,
yeah.
And you see them in like the Honolulu Advertiser or the Asheville Times Tribune newspaper, all these kind of like provincial newspapers that carry stories like this saying, well, they must be the same thing. You know, they might have been, but they might not have been as well. Who knows?
I've seen some of those early letters to certain American newspapers. It is remarkable how entrained that kind of belief system is in people, that if there's strange things in the sky, Graham, it must be the Germans, even though the war's over. And let's be honest, if they're seeing things over America, where the bloody hell have they come from? Because I'm sure somebody would have seen a German aircraft carrier wandering around somewhere at some point. And therefore, why on earth would the Germans be flying sorties 2 years after the war's finished in places like Oregon and Washington, which, with the greatest of respect, were not strategically important parts of the American continent at that particular time? Really? I mean, there may have been a few secret bases squirreled away up there or some training facilities, but they weren't big sort of military bases up there. You didn't have massive naval shipyards around that area. There were...
You did have the Hanford nuclear plant, however. The atomic plant at Hanford.
Yeah, that's true.
But of course, there were UFO stories over there in late 44 and early 1945.
Yeah.
There was a US Navy detachment of Hellcats who were based at an airfield at Pasco, which was near the plant.
Yes.
Which is only like, you know, minutes flying time away. There was at least about, you know, three or four episodes where they were sent after things hovering over the plant. In early 1945. So, and I've written about those in the past for Outer Limits, for Chris's magazine.
Yeah.
So, those stories do exist. So this is how you can sort of go, well, there can't be German secret weapons or something that the Americans took, you know, got a hold of and then took back home and start trying to test around the Pacific Northwest in 47, because these stories of strange things exist even before that. So you can kind of see where people are coming from when they're thinking these things, but actually it doesn't stand up to scrutiny. And actually it wasn't just people writing to newspapers. It was some of the so-called air intelligence staff who were looking at the discs themselves. There's one newspaper story that appears, and you see it syndicated because it appears in newspaper after newspaper in early July 47, and it talks about an air intelligence officer, and they don't name him, but he says it was the same thing as the Foo Fighters. You know, it was a German secret weapon. And you just think, how do you know that? You know, I would love to know the rationale behind that. I would love to see the report where he goes to his superiors and says, the German secret weapon, sir, you know, and because I haven't come across it yet. And I think I'm not entirely sure that's just paper talk. You know, so because I've never seen anything to back it up. The only talk of the Foo Fighters that I can see in terms of a historical document is when the Robertson panel comes along in January 1953, and they talk about the Foo Fighters. They say, you know, if we were doing the same things we're doing now back in the war, they would have the same level of reporting, would be saying these are things on what we're seeing as we're seeing now. So they talk about the parallels. But that's about the first time that the Foo Fighters are actually referred to officially, you know, in any kind of UFO related documents, which you can find, you can easily find. So yeah, it's funny how things come around though, isn't it? I mean, even now we're talking about, You know, now we're talking about UAP over military bases in 2025. And yet we've got stories back then of, you know, of military pilots seeing things in close proximity to air bases, you know, on the continent, et cetera. So, yeah, it does just come around every so often, doesn't it? There's nothing new in ufology, like a lot of subjects.
It is, but it's also remarkably blasé of them as well, Graham, because to brush these things off as, oh, well, you know, they're just German secret weapons. Oh,
well,
thank goodness for that.
All the time, though, don't they? You know, they brush things off. So they brush things off in World War II. Yeah. They brush things off in 1947 and in the subsequent years where, you know, the Americans are sending jet interceptors up after things that they might have thought were Russian, but because they weren't doing any harm, it was like, oh, well, we don't know what these things are. You know, even though it was rendering the US Air Force impotent, especially over Washington 2 weekends in 1952. Yeah. So you have these kind of capabilities where they're maybe just sticking their head in the sand because can't deal with them. And that's the kind of story that goes on through the decades. And now, even now, we've got these things which they don't know what they are, or they're saying they don't know what they are, but they're flying around bases. And, well, they shouldn't be, unless they're yours. Because if they're not yours, then you have some explaining to do why we're spending a lot of tax dollars for you to sit on your backsides and do nothing.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Yes. Yes, and I always find it remarkable how things are very easily explained when it often defies logic, and the ludicrous explanations for things over the years, Graham, is a classic. One of my favourites always makes me chuckle, especially about this time of year, is obviously the famous Kakura sighting from the 1970s.
Oh, yeah.
Which one member of the Australian Air Force explained away as light reflecting off a cabbage field, which I think
that's inventive, though, isn't it? You know, when you think about it, somebody had to come up with that. What can we call? Ooh, yeah, a cabbage field. Yeah, that's a really good idea, mate. Yeah, fly it's a cabbage field, and they'll really believe it. That's a crap Australian accent, I know, but you know what I mean.
I do. Just, I do.
That's brilliant.
It is. I mean, I think the other thing they said was prawn trawlers or something of that. But that's fine if you hadn't seen the footage, I think, because then you would be saying, well, why is a prawn trawler flying in the sky then? Because that footage is remarkable, really. And it's a story that's always stayed with me, primarily because I think the main reporter is called Quentin Fogarty, which I think is one of
that's
the best
names
you could ever have for a live investigation into strange phenomena in the skies. And it is very compelling. It's a very odd incident that was going on, because it wasn't just that particular one. They'd gone up there because there'd been so many reports about it. But it happens time and again. Like you say, these things come around, these kind of explanations, and we get this now everywhere. You know, it's Venus. It's a weather balloon. It's just some kind of military tech. What, they're testing near an aircraft full of extremely expensive killing machines that can bring anything down at a moment's notice. That is not my idea of testing your own tech. If anything, that's a very good way of getting your own soldiers and airmen killed.
Stuff like that, they tend to test under very, very regimented conditions in areas away from other things, so nothing goes wrong. They're not going to basically, you know, put it into an area where there's a kind of wild card in so much as things they can't control. So, you know, they don't tell somebody over another airfield, oh, we're going to test it over there, because they don't know how they're going to react, do they? So, you know, you don't have these kind of situations where it might go pear-shaped. But, yeah, you look at the Blue Book reports from the 1950s and the stuff I've written about, and you see the kind of facts that appear in the Air Intelligence Information Report to do with a certain sighting. And then you see the evaluation by the Air Force or by, you know, by ATIC or by Air Materiel Command who came before that, when it was like Sassine or Grudge who were looking at these reports. And you see the disparity between the facts and what the evaluation was. And you think, well, how the hell did it get there from there? And when you got to the point of when it was Captain George Gregory who was in charge of Blue Book in the sort of mid to late 50s, if there was a hint of a balloon being anywhere near the vicinity of a sighting, well, that's what it was.
Yes.
Because he was a career Air Force man. He wasn't bothered about whether, you know, these were little green men or whether, you know, it was a weather balloon. All he wanted to do was for the reports, the clear-up rate to look good. So when he reported back to his superiors every month, it was like, oh, yes, sir, we have solved 100 cases this month. You know, don't I look great? You know, that's all he wanted, because he wanted to be out and he wanted to be somewhere else. That was a dead-end job for him, probably. And he wanted to be doing something, anything but looking at UFO reports. And it might have been kind of a punishment detail for all we know. That was something he was landed with. And when he found, you know, what it was about, he probably just didn't want to do it. So, you know, the quickest way was to make himself look good and you get promoted. You know, so why go into the where, when's and how when he can just write things off as something mundane? And that's case solved, sir, you know. Yeah. And you see it time and time again when you read through those reports of, say, 1956, 1957, 1958, when he was in charge. You know, there's a lot of stuff like that where it's like, well, how the hell do you get to there from there? Because I can't make that link. So how the hell can they? Yeah. You know, it's just like, no, it doesn't make sense. Does it?
I've read so many reports from that era where the explanation given is often more baffling than what people have seen. I think one of my particular favourites was from the mid-50s where a UFO hovered over a street. I think that was in Maryland. And came so close that a woman wet herself. She was so scared in the street, Graham. And it was seen by 40 other witnesses moving around. They explain that as she misunderstood Venus.
Yes, that was always... you see, the thing is, on the surface, when somebody reads it, when they don't see the detail, it's like, okay, well, that might be right. And, you know, newspaper reporters, because they wouldn't have access at the time to that kind of detail, they would only see, you know, the bare hint of the kind of report, and then they would see the evaluation and the US Air Force's attempts to kind of, you know, justify what they were saying. And that would just be, okay, that's fine. But if you then, with a benefit of hindsight, we can dive into this detail. And I'm all about the detail, as you know.
Yes.
And that's when you get the nuances. That's when you get the context. That's when you get that kind of nitty gritty that you can look at and go, yeah, I can't see how you can get Venus from this. But that's not what the public, that's not what the press got. They got the top line, and they were happy with that because, well, they were getting information from the Air Force, and of course the Air Force don't lie, or they don't embellish stuff, or they don't, you know, misdirect people. So, you know, they were quite happy with all that, especially after 1952 when they had that infamous press conference after those two weekends in Washington, when you had the director of intelligence, you know, John Sanford, and the radar, so-called radar experts who thought it was all just, you know, weather inversions and all the rest of it. The press basically went, okay, that's fine, you know, there's a rational explanation for all this. And it got the kind of fever, and that's why I called the book Flying Saucer Fever, that looks at 50 to 52. There was a fever building up, and then it would just basically went away because the press were quite happy with the US Air Force's explanation for what was going on in the skies. They lapped it all up, and it went a bit flat after that for a little while, even though they were still reporting stories, but it wasn't really quite the same kind of what's going on kind of, you know, kind of questioning from the press.
Yeah.
They were happy just to go, yeah, it's just people seeing Venus, you know, and that's where the little bit of the ridicule started creeping into this kind of stuff as well, which we now, you know, we've taken for granted over the last few decades. Yeah. It's coming back, however, much more serious now, as we know.
Thankfully. I mean, is that still baffles me. I think if you look at some reports that are dismissed as people seeing Venus, Graham, you only have to go outside and look at the night sky. I mean, especially right now, Venus is beautiful and clear and has been for several weeks. And you can pick, I don't know, dozens of UFO experiences and think, right, I'm going to read this experience. And you'll see, like, I saw the craft 200 feet above me in the air. They said it's Venus. And then you look at Venus, you think, hang on a minute, that doesn't look anything like.
Yeah.
It's 200 feet above me. It looks like a beautifully bright dot in the sky.
And Venus is just a pinprick of light.
Yeah.
It never gets to the point where it could be even described as like the size of a cent coin or a half pence piece or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It doesn't move around in violent maneuvers. Yes, sometimes when it's near the horizon, if you do have the benefit of seeing it near the horizon, you get the scintillation. Like you would with other stars, you get that kind of, you know, or other planets rather. Because you have to keep remembering that Venus is a planet, it's not a star.
Yes.
But when you see stars near the horizon, you do get that kind of like color change sometimes, and you do get that kind of movement very, very occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
And that might throw some people off. But if it's high in the sky, you're not going to get that kind of movement around that is reported. So, yeah, it was an easy thing to tell people and an easy thing for the press to buy. But when you look in the detail, it doesn't add up. And that's so, you know, you can see that with so many other cases about a whole load of other things.
Yes.
When things are just like some kind of mundane, rational explanation is put forward for extraordinary events.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not just Venus, it's weather balloons or, you know, reflections from light. Lights inside the aircraft, you name it, all the things that people have you know, put forward, and you just go, really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, I was somebody as a young child when I used to wake up very early, Grant. So I've seen many a sunrise and seen many a star on a sunrise.
Mm.
And it is remarkable. I remember being a young kid, I don't know, 8 or 9, and I used to sit on my windowsill on a morning watching it. I used to love it. And you'd see the stars almost like change colour. And in my 9-year-old head, I was thinking, oh, my goodness, are they having a war on that star there? Is that what's going on? Is that why the colours are changing? Obviously, my father was a doctor of chemistry,
yeah.
And he explained it. It's all about atmosphere, and that's why the colours are changing, and it's the time of day and the sunlight and everything. And after that, I was like, right, I no longer think that these planets are having wars first thing in the morning. But that's what you do when you're 9. And so I think they work on this principle, Graham, that they either presume people are as stupid as they think they are, or that nobody can be bothered to look at the report in regards to the explanation. And that, I think, is one of the things that perhaps over the last 20 years has completely fallen away now, that they can't hide behind this shield of assuming the public is stupid, because for a lot of us, we know if anybody's being stupid, it's those guys.
Yeah, and also social media has a lot. I mean, social media is a bit of an ill. It can be really bad, but it's got a lot to be thankful for in terms of this, because a lot of people then can go, this is wrong, and this is how you're wrong.
Yes.
You know, they can explain in detail how that's completely incorrect, whereas he didn't have that years ago. You know, it was just the press lapping it up, and there was nobody to come and question it. Or if he did question things, it was years after the event when it finally got into the public, you know, into the public realm. And by then it was too late because nobody give a damn anymore. So, yeah, nowadays things are much more instant. So, you know, there's a thing, you know, there's a story released, and then everybody jumps on it, and then, you know, there's independent photo analysts, video analysts, people who look into stories. You've got citizen journalists nowadays. Everybody's, you know, wants a bit of a story to look at in themselves, so they can't get away with this stuff anymore. They can't fool people. They can fool some of the people some of the time, but they can't fool all of the people all the time. And that's when, you know, the likes of you and me and everybody else comes in, who's interested in this, comes in. We're the people who then kind of pick holes in the argument and question things and say, well, hold on, how can you say that? And that's when these kind of little facades kind of fall away. That's not to say that everything that's put out there, which is put forward as a UFO, is a UFO.
Yes. Yeah, of course.
Because a lot of things are simply misidentifications, and we accept that. Yep. It's always been that way. But and then even with some of these mystery footage of drones, when you look at some of them, you think, well, that's just a helicopter. Yeah. That is a commercial aeroplane. Because people genuinely, at times, don't know what they're looking at.
Yeah.
But there's still a hardcore of, you know, sort of footage that just defies any kind of rational explanation. There may well be an explanation at some time, which actually, well, somebody hasn't considered, or it turns out that these were something mundane. But in the meantime, there's a lot of stuff out there which I've seen, which I'm not entirely sure what they are. And I'm no photo or video expert, you know, myself, and I'll hold my hands up in that respect. But to me, just as like kind of a first glance, it's like, well, that definitely bears more scrutiny.
Mm. Absolutely. Well, I think, Graham, we've barely scratched the surface. I could talk to you all night about this and dive into this and the minutiae of it, because, as I said in the introduction, the quality of your work and the analysis that you've brought with your ongoing series of books, which I recommend to anybody with an interest in this particular subject, to get some real meat on the bones of some of these cases, especially in this Second World War period, because everybody looks at Roswell, and yet you've got so many reports included in these books. I mean, your latest book is talking about the UFO flap in France. Hopefully one day I'll have to pick your brains about that particular book, because that could probably take us another 10 hours to get through some of the wonderful cases you've got in that. I think they are essential books for anybody with an interest in ufology, Graham, and I love the way you write. I love the detail you bring to it, and long may it continue, my friend. So where can everybody find your work, find your YouTube channel, and get hold of some of your brilliant books that you've released so far, sir?
Okay, so I'm available on Amazon, and I had a run-in with Amazon last year, but that's all settled now. So you can still get my books on Amazon. So UFOs Before Roswell, which is the book about the European Foo Fighters, World War II. There is Dawn of the Flying Saucers, that looks at aerial cases between 46 and 49. Flying Saucer Fever, which has a foreword by Lou Elizondo, of all people. Similarly, aerial cases between 50 and 52. Intercept and Identify, and Chasing Shadows. They're the books that deal with the UFO, the aerial cases, so airborne UFO encounters. As you mentioned, we've got the book about the 1954 autumn wave of sightings, which, yeah, it's a fascinating period of time. But they're all available from Amazon. And I'm working on a follow-up to the UFOs Before Roswell book at the moment, and I've sort of got a bit of a 1957 and 1958 book going as well. So I'm always busy. Amazon's the place to go to. If you are on Twitter and you follow me on Twitter, then if you're in the UK and you want a signed copy, and I've got stocks of any of those books, then by all means hit me up on by direct message, and I'll see if I can get for the suitable payment, I'll get a signed copy to you. I'm happy to do that. To cover for an amount to cover the book and the postage. I've done that in the past for people, so that's no problem. I am on Facebook, but I don't really use it because there's some batshit crazy people on there.
Thanks, Graham.
The present company accepted, of course. But there are some really, really odd people in some of those UFO groups on Facebook.
Yeah.
I tend to stay clear of that, because I just bump my head against a brick wall. I'm sorry. And if you want to see some coverage of some like really obscure historical UFO cases, I've got a YouTube channel called Bite-Sized UFOs.
Yeah.
So I cover some stuff in detail, and those videos are anywhere between 3 or 4 minutes to like half an hour long for one case. Mm-hmm. And I do have a couple of long form documentaries in there as well about certain aspects of ufology, including World War II UFOs. So yeah, if you want to subscribe to Bite-Sized UFOs, I'd appreciate that as well. That's everything. And occasionally I'll do a conference in the UK, like Hull last year. You mentioned the Outer Limits conference. I've been across to America a couple of times.
Yes.
I've presented at Roswell back in 2023. That was really good. So yeah, you might see at a conference in the UK or somewhere else, in the future as well. And if you see me anywhere, come say hi. I'm friendly. I don't bite.
Graham, thank you. I'll put links to everything in the show notes. I just want to say thank you very much for finally joining me. Not that that was down to yourself at all. That was down to me just dilly-dallying as usual. And I really look forward to getting a chance to speak to you again. Like I say, the your most recent book, The French Wave, I just found it wonderful. And I love books, especially for us here in the UK, they're focusing on some of these strange events that happened over Europe, because I don't think we've got anywhere near enough resource and material about a lot of these cases. So I wish you all the very best for the rest of this year and your continued endeavours, sir. And thank you again, Graham.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Paul. It's been a pleasure. And I've really enjoyed the questions as well, which always makes it worthwhile for me, because I like to be stretched as well. it's great. It's great to have somebody who knows about the subject as well and comes across, you know, with some great questions and really kind of pushes me. So that's I really do appreciate that. Thank you.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.